In 1995, NYPD Detective Peter Fraselli helped convict Edward Gary, a man he thought was responsible for the murder of a retired police officer named Oswald Potter. But subsequent evidence has led Fraselli to doubt the verdict, and he has been fighting to overturn the conviction of a man who has spent the past 20 years in jail. New Yorker contributor Stephanie Clifford investigates what happened in this case in an article called A Shot in the Heart, part of the magazine's Annals of Justice series. And I'm very pleased it has brought Stephanie Clifford to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
How did you hear about Peter Fraselli and Edward Gary?
I had covered wrongful convictions for quite a while for the New York Times, and this piece is for the New Yorker. So the case kind of came across my desk, and I looked at it. It looked to be more or less a standard case. And then I noticed that this cop, that Peter Fraselli, the actual cop who had arrested Edward Gary back in 1995, was now testifying on his behalf, trying to get him out.
And was he open to talking to you about what happened in the Gary case when you contacted him?
He was, which surprised me. I thought he would be a little reticent to talk about this mistake he thought he'd made. But he feels so strongly that Gary should be released that he wanted to talk about it and he wanted to get the word out.
Tell us a bit about Detective Fraselli. What brought him to the NYPD?
He grew up in the Bronx in a working class background. His dad was a construction worker but was often out of work, so they would eat Cheerios for dinner sometimes because money was so low. And he grew up in a mixed race, mixed income neighborhood. And always wanted to be a cop ever since he saw a Yonkers cop who used their backyard for a parking spot. He'd kind of corner him and talk about police work. He actually took the test to join the NYPD at 16 and a half, 4 years before he was actually allowed to join because he was so eager to start on this road.
And this is a Bronx story.
Yeah. Both men are Bronx men. They grew up about 3 miles apart from each other in the Bronx, and they're both from similar backgrounds. Their dads had, in fact, the same union construction work.
Would his attitude about cop killers have tainted his investigation?
About?
The Gary investigation. Because when a police officer, in this case a retired one, under very what word do we want to use? Confusing circumstances.
Yeah.
Is killed. There's an immediate. Suddenly, the whole New York police force has to find the murderer immediately.
Yeah, and there was enormous pressure on him then to solve this case as quickly as possible because Oswald Potter, the dead man, was a retired detective. So immediately, you know, on normal cases back then in 1995, the NYPD would put two people on a murder. On this one, they put 40 people to help solve this case.
But Fraselli was working at the 47th Precinct at the time, and that was the one that responded first to the shooting?
It occurred in the 47th Precinct.
What role did Comstat play in the way the case was handled?
It's interesting. Comstat started about the year before, and it was a program that Benjamin Bratton put into place as the new commissioner. The idea was to halt crime, or at least get a hold on crime, by adding some statistical analysis to it. So suddenly lieutenants, sergeants, captains, and officers were held responsible for the crimes in their precinct. And if they didn't solve their crimes quickly enough, they were reprimanded. So
Added to the pressure.
That added to the pressure, exactly. And there was already there were so many murders then. It was such a crazy time for policing where there were dead bodies pretty much every day. And Comstat added an increased pressure.
What happened on that night, August 18th, 1995? It was at Irene's New Hope grocery store.
Right. And in the front of this grocery store, which is on was on Laconia Avenue in the Bronx, was a normal grocery store. And the back was an illegal numbers spot where older men would come and play dominoes or bet on the numbers. So Oswald Potter, this retired detective, went there regularly to drink beers and play.
Even though it was illegal.
It was illegal, but there was so much else going on that the cops sort of looked the other way. So there was a normal game in the back, and then these two men burst in, one who witnesses described as a Hispanic man, one as a black man, holding guns, saying, "This is a holdup, we need money." Potter pulls out his gun, gets in a scuffle with one of them. They run into the front of the store, people hear gunshots, and by the time people run out. After Potter, he's about to die. He's been shot.
How many people presented themselves as eyewitnesses?
There were a number in the store, but police eventually settled on two of them because a lot of the eyewitnesses could not give good descriptions of these two men.
The two were Antonio Vargas and Gladys Garcia, but didn't they remember the perpetrators differently?
They did, and it gets at this problem of eyewitness identification, which we know much more about today and didn't know much about then. They described the perpetrators differently. They said they were wearing different clothes. Their accounts were not that consistent.
And then how did Edward Gary become a suspect?
He was in the mugshots, in the mugshot files in the Bronx NYPD files.
And how did he wind up in the mugshot files?
From prior arrests. He'd done a year on Rikers for an assault case. So he was in there in the kind of Hispanic men files. They had the witnesses go through those photographs, and both of them eventually, after some hesitation, picked out Gary as one of the
Well, one picked him out right away. The other one didn't.
Right. Vargas, the young man who picked him out, picked out a couple of other people and then said, I think this is him. This might be him, but was quite uncertain.
And his mugshot was there because he wasn't a good guy.
But he had committed crimes, yeah.
What was his story all about?
He grew up in the Bronx in the Boston Secor housing projects, and his upbringing was partly stable. His parents were both employed. They were married except for a one-year separation. But he started to get into drugs and dealing at around 16, spent a year on Rikers. And his explanation was that everybody did this, and that's what he did too. There just wasn't really another option.
You spoke to him?
I went to Sing Sing to visit him, yeah.
And what did he say about his arrest? He must have been surprised.
He was surprised, but he'd been arrested before, and he thought that this, like other times, would work itself out. So he figured the system would do its job, and he would be free in a few days. That did not happen.
My guest is Stephanie Clifford, whose article, A Shot to the Heart, is in New Yorker magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Forselli, I'm going to get back to the case in a moment, but Forselli left his detective job. Why did he leave?
He got frustrated with the way NYPD investigates cases, where there's a push to close the case, meaning to make an arrest. And after that, cops usually stop investigating because the workload is so heavy.
But hadn't he done exactly that in the Gary case?
Yeah, exactly. And
was he feeling guilty?
Not about that case in particular. It didn't really linger with him until recently. But he had done some co-investigations with federal agents who continue investigating until trial. And he thought that was a better way to go, that so many facts come out after the arrest.
So he left the NYPD and became a federal investigator?
Right. He joined ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, in 2001.
And he prefers doing that?
He does. It's a lighter workload in terms of cases and a much longer time frame. So he feels that you get to do much more thorough investigations.
How soon after Gary's arrest was he found guilty? What happened?
It was 2 years. So he was arrested in 1995, and then the trial was in 97, but he was incarcerated the whole time. So the last time he spent a day outside was 1995.
And saying, I'm innocent. Did he have an alibi?
His alibi was that he was at his apartment with his parents watching TV. And they presented that alibi at trial, but it didn't, at least from reading the transcripts, it didn't come across as that convincing, because, of course, parents are going to say anything to keep their kid out of trouble, and the prosecutor was pretty effective in attacking that alibi.
Even though it was probably true?
Yeah.
And what was his sentence?
25 to life.
He's been in jail for 20 years now, so even if he is exonerated, he has pretty much spent done the whole sentence.
Yeah, he's in his early 40s, and he's, I think, fearful about, as much as he wants to get out, he's also fearful about what would happen if he were to be released, because he doesn't have vocational training, he didn't finish high school, he spent the last 20 years literally behind bars, and he doesn't know what the outside world is like anymore.
Did he file for an appeal? Did he find a lawyer who believed him?
He's filed for 5 appeals. He's now in the midst of his 5th formal appeal on grounds of new evidence emerging in this case, but the other 4 have been denied.
On what grounds? Because some of this evidence sounds quite convincing.
I think it is quite convincing, and I think this new appeal, which pulls together all of this new evidence in the case, is a pretty strong one. So I'm interested to see what will happen.
Because there was pressure on the police to solve the case and resolve it as quickly as possible, did they even bother looking for other possible suspects?
You know, they did. I mean, the police notes, they talked to everybody in the neighborhood. They knocked on more than 550 doors trying to get information. But once they had the 2 eyewitnesses pick out the same guy, pick out Edward Gary, they thought their work was done, and that they didn't follow up on other leads.
But usually, at least in the movies, they look for fingerprints. Were Gary's fingerprints there?
No, there was no. They looked for fingerprints, but nothing was recovered. There was no physical evidence connecting Gary to the scene. There was nothing suggesting he was in the area at that time. There were just these 2 eyewitnesses who were not that certain.
And then there's this man named Stephen Martinez.
Martinez.
Right. His fingerprints were there.
They were actually not there. Huh. But later on, Forselli came across information that Martinez might also have been a suspect in this case.
And we'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out how that worked out. When Lawrence Broussard identified Stephen Martinez, also known as Flip, as the killer, we'll find out whether he might actually have been the killer. My guest is has written an article for The New Yorker called A Shot in the Heart as part of its Annals of Justice series. Do you do a lot of Annals of Justice articles?
This is my first.
It is in the current issue of The New Yorker, and we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Stephanie Clifford, who has investigated what happened in a crime that involved NYPD Detective Peter Forselli. It is in the as part of the magazines, the New York magazine's Annals of Justice series. It's called A Shot in the Heart and is in the current issue. When did Lawrence Broussard come into this story?
Lawrence Broussard comes in about 2006. He's arrested on a federal gun charge. And federal prosecutors in Manhattan bring this guy in to say, what do you know about other crimes? Can you proffer? Which is a system where defendants tell everything about crimes they've been part of or they know about in return for a reduced sentence.
And this is 11 years after the killing.
Right. And Broussard happens to mention, by the way, I was one of 4 guys involved in the shooting of Oswald Potter in 1995. Now, at the time, remember, there's only been 1 man arrested and convicted for the crime, Edward Gary, who's still serving time. So Broussard comes kind of out of nowhere to say, no, it was me.
And so, how do we know that Broussard wasn't the one who shot Potter?
Broussard is black, and all of the witnesses describe that the man who shot Potter was Hispanic, that there was 1 black man, 1 Hispanic man, but the Hispanic man did the shooting.
Has Stephen Martinez confessed to killing killing Potter?
No. So it's a bit of a convoluted story, but Broussard says there are 3 other men that I did this crime with. One of them is this guy named Flip. Eventually, he's shown a photo array, including a man named Stephen Martinez, who's currently in prison in Minnesota. And he says, oh, that's Flip, Stephen Martinez.
How did the Exoneration Initiative get involved in Gary's case?
Gary wrote to them in 2010 after another one of his appeals was turned down, saying, can you take a look at this? And the Exoneration Initiative is a nonprofit in Manhattan that handles these wrongful conviction cases. And they looked at it and said, you know, this is so typical of what we see from cases from the 1990s where there were 2 eyewitnesses, nothing else. And so they took the case pretty quickly after that.
Rebecca Friedman and Glenn Garbett?
Garber, mm-hmm.
Now, Broussard admitted to being involved in the robbery in 2006. That was 10 years ago.
Right.
What's taken so long?
The federal prosecutors then arrested the two other men that they could identify for being involved in this crime. They, over time, admitted to being involved. And the question was, who was this fourth guy? Was it Edward Gary, or was it Stephen Martinez, or was it somebody else altogether? So lately, there's been some new developments in the case that Peter Forselli was involved in, where Rebecca Friedman and Glenn Garber, these new lawyers for Gary, obtained some documents that nobody had seen for years that had Peter Forselli's name on it. And it turned out that back in 1996, while Peter was investigating another case, he considered Stephen Martinez as one of the suspects in this 1995 shooting. And he hadn't thought about this in years. He'd kind of put it away. And when this came to his attention, he had this reckoning where he felt, oh, my God, I got the wrong guy.
So when they contacted Peter Forselli, he began to doubt that Gary was guilty?
Yeah, he knew that the lawyers were looking into the case, and he began to wonder, well, what did I do wrong? I did that case by the book. Then there was this moment in court in 2014 as they brought the first part of this current appeal where Glenn Garber handed him a photo of Stephen Martinez, and Forselli looks at the photo of Martinez and then looks up at Gary in the courtroom and sees that they look almost exactly alike. And it's so clear to him at that point that he, in his mind, he got the wrong guy from a mistaken ID.
So why is Gary still not a free man?
This is the problem with the system. So in order to get out on wrongful convictions, it's very, very difficult. Innocence alone in New York as of 2 years ago is now a reason. But generally, the whole appeals process is set up to address errors at trial or errors during the police work, and not the idea that we got the wrong guy completely.
As of just 2 years ago? What happened 2 years ago?
There was a decision in People versus Derek Hamilton where they said that actual innocence is grounds for relief. But
and that seemed like a logical decision. How come nobody had thought of it before?
It's been tried, and some states have it, but federally too, they've declined to take cases based on innocence alone.
Is the fact that this took place in the Bronx also a factor? Because in Brooklyn, we have seen a flurry of exoneration cases.
Right. And in Brooklyn, the district attorney there, Ken Thompson, now deceased, expanded a unit to look at these cases so that the prosecutor's office was actively involved in reviewing these cases and moving to vacate these cases. In the Bronx, Darcelle Clark, the new district attorney there, started a unit in, I think, March to do the same thing. And they've so far looked at one case. They're starting to look at Edward Gary's case, but they're not moving, it seems, quite as fast as the Brooklyn prosecutors are.
What's unique about the Bronx? Do they have different rules?
They don't have different rules. It's sort of up to the prosecutors about whether they want to establish these units and what they want to do in them. You know, the Bronx courts, like all of our city courts, are overloaded, so this case has been dragging on. This current appeal started in 2014, and we're now in 2016. The judge just set a schedule for a decision, which will happen in 2017. Mm. So we're now 3 years into this, and it's...
Well, that's foot-dragging, considering the fact that this guy is probably innocent. He's going to have to stay in Sing Sing the whole time while they work it out.
Right, and he's really losing faith now. I think he feels like the prosecutors have the truth at their hands and they're just not addressing it, and he's spending day after day inside Sing Sing.
Could you talk a bit about the Lacey Little case?
Yeah, so Forselli, one interesting thing about him is he began to investigate wrongful convictions before he knew that he might have caused one. So as an ATF agent, he was interviewing a defendant who said, I know about this murder, another Bronx murder. So Forselli started to look into this, and then he came to believe that the Bronx prosecutors had arrested the wrong man. They were about to go to trial. with a defendant named Lacey Little in this murder. Forcelli follows up, finds out that this man named Tyrone Glynn had actually done it, drives up to Shawangunk Prison, interviews Glynn, gets a confession on the spot, arrests him. And he still said that until he arrested him and until that happened, the Bronx prosecutors refused to entertain this idea that they had the wrong guy.
And why are prosecutors so reluctant to reopen a case? Because they got the conviction and they don't want to look bad?
I think that's part of it, that a jury convicted and they feel that that's a fair process and that at some point the justice system needs some finality, that you can't reexamine every single case because the system would be overwhelmed. At the same time, as more and more of these wrongful convictions happen, as it becomes clear that this is a bigger and bigger problem, I think prosecutors may have to adjust that attitude.
In Brooklyn, many of the wrongful conviction cases involved a detective who has been accused of doing all sorts of unethical things. Have similar accusations been made about the way the Bronx conducts its activities?
No, and that's one interesting thing here, is that Forcelli and his colleagues believed they were doing the right thing and they were playing by the rules. There were no forced confessions in this case. There were no, you know, crack-addicted witnesses giving the same story that they'd given in other cases as they had in those Brooklyn cases. But they still got the wrong guy.
And it turns out, if I'm reading my newspaper correctly, that there have been many wrongful convictions. Why are there so many wrongful convictions?
Yeah, there are. Since 1989, when DNA evidence first really came into play, there have been close to 2,000 listed wrongful convictions, which is just a staggering number.
Most of them murder cases?
Yeah. A lot murder, for the most part, at least in the Brooklyn cases and these Bronx cases, these men have more or less been in jail since then, that they have served 20, 25 years.
You visited Edward Gary at Sing Sing. What was he like? Was he reluctant to talk to you?
He was very polite, very formal, and ill at ease. He was shifting around in his seat. He didn't really make eye contact. You could tell that a lot of the social graces that he may have had have faded away inside of prison. He has stopped leaving his cell to go to meals. He kind of cooks from commissary food. He gave the story about a cat that he had adopted, sort of quasi-adopted, that roamed the hallways at one prison. And he fed this cat for a year and a half, putting out Jack Mac, which is prison kind of tuna, in the hallways. And he never gave the cat a name, and that struck me because he was so longing for some kind of contact, yet still so wary that he didn't want to name that.
And this is not unusual. Some years ago, I spoke to a filmmaker who'd made a film about other people who'd been wrongfully convicted, and one who had been exonerated in Georgia and been given money. And he just sat in his room, and his family said, well, why don't you take some of that money and go to Europe or do something, have some fun with it? And he couldn't leave the room. He didn't feel safe outside of the room.
Yeah.
He'd lived in a cell so long.
And I think prison does that to a lot of people. But if you're in there for a crime you didn't commit, I think the loss of faith is pretty staggering.
And you said that Gary has kind of lost faith in the system, even though it looks like he probably will be exonerated in the trial?
He has been inside for so long, and he's had so many attempts at getting out that have failed, that I think he's given up a little bit. He's fighting with his dad, who's kind of been by his side the whole time. He's fighting with his aunt.
Fighting in what way? Did his friends and family think that he actually had committed the crime?
No. His parents never did.
Well, he was home with his family.
Right. So. I'm not sure about his friends. As he says, his friends faded away and don't visit anymore. They've moved on with their lives, and he's stuck inside Sing Sing. I think he's angry, too. He's angry at his father now for not doing more to investigate the case when really his dad shouldn't be investigating the case. That's what the lawyers are for. But there's this undercurrent of anger at not just the system, but everybody on the outside who's not doing more to help him.
Why is the jury conviction rate in the Bronx lower than in any of the other five boroughs?
And it's strikingly lower. I think it's something like 47%, and elsewhere it's quite a bit higher. The theory on that is that the Bronx has the highest non-white population, and it's also the poorest borough, and that people there have had a long distrust of police, and that's coming out now in these jury conviction rates, that as they see perhaps wrongful convictions or their neighbors being arrested for things that they didn't do, they're starting to kind of vote with their in the jury box and say, we don't stand for that.
Well, it was a factor in the O.J. Simpson case.
Right.
A listener wonders, why can't clemency resolve a case like this?
I don't know the legal wranglings well enough to answer that. I'm not sure.
What role do judges play in the final decisions here?
Well, here there are two routes that Gary could be exonerated through. One is through this conviction integrity unit, which would have to move to vacate his conviction. The second is through this ongoing hearing, and a judge has all the power in that. He will decide whether Gary gets a new trial, whether he's exonerated fully, or whether he stays in prison.
But then he'd have to go through a whole new trial to prove what seems to have been proven?
Yeah, and most of these cases where a new trial is granted, the prosecutors won't try it because it's been 20 years. The evidence is 20 years old, and times have changed. We're now much more wary of eyewitness testimony, and the case would be a lot shakier than it was in 1997.
Can judges overrule juries in the Bronx?
I don't know. Hmm. I don't know.
Because we have heard of that sort of thing happening elsewhere, at least in other states.
Yeah.
Where a jury finds not guilty and the judge says, no, he's guilty of sin. He's going to jail.
Yeah, I think it's very rare in New York cases. The prosecutors do their job, the jury convicts, and the judge, unless something extraordinary has happened. I've never seen a judge overturn a jury verdict, but.
But in telling this story, the suggestion is that nobody did this on purpose, that all the mistakes were made just because the system works that way.
Right, and that's one of the frustrating things about this story is if you have a case where you have a corrupt cop or a racist prosecutor, you can point to them and say, well, they're the problem. Here, it's a system-wide problem where it's a system that's set up to be quick to arrest, quick to conviction. It's adversarial, so the prosecutors get entrenched in their position. And then once a verdict is reached, it's so hard to overturn it. It's so hard to get hearings. It's so hard to find new evidence. In that way, Gary is oddly one of the lucky ones where he has lawyers working on this, but that's uncommon.
When you spoke to Peter Fraselli about Edward Gary, did you get a sense that he's feeling guilty about his role in all of this?
Yeah, he is, because Fraselli thought of himself as a stand-up law and order guy who always was doing the right thing, even if it hurt his career, even if it hurt his colleagues, that he spoke for the truth. And so the idea that he's the one who helped arrest and helped convict this guy who took 20 years away from him is eating at him.
And what about Gary? Does he know what Fraselli's been doing?
He does, because Fraselli's actually testified in these hearings. So the first time Fraselli testified, Gary assumed, well, here's another cop to say I'm guilty. And he said he was shocked when he heard what Fraselli actually had to say, that Fraselli thought he was innocent and that Fraselli himself had made a mistake. And he said, that's a real cop. That's what you want.
But meanwhile, he's been in jail for 20 years for a crime that he probably didn't commit.
Right.
The article by Stephanie Clifford is in the current issue of The New Yorker as part of the magazine's Annals of Justice series. It is called A Shot to the Heart. And my great thanks to Stephanie Clifford for coming by to talk about it on our show today.
Thank you
so much.
My pleasure.